Hi everyone. Welcome to the 657 participants who've joined us for tonight's webinar and to all of the viewers watching the podcast as well. Emerging Minds and MHPN wishes to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands across Australia upon which our webinar presenters and participants are located. We wish to pay respect to the elders past, present and future, for the memories, the traditions, the culture and the hopes of Indigenous Australia. Hi everyone, thank you for joining us tonight. My name is Jackie Lee and I'll be facilitating tonight's session. I joined Emerging Minds as a communications officer and editor in late 2018, where I work closely with Dan Moss, who you might know from previous webinars, and with our authors and content producers to produce engaging, innovative and evidence-based content on infant and child mental health. I'm especially interested in practice approaches that engage with children and families and empower them as experts in their own lives. So I'm really looking forward to tonight's session. So tonight is the first in the third series of webinars from Emerging Minds and MHPN. Along with tonight's session, this year we'll be bringing you webinars on engaging fathers and children on the 29th of October and on the micro skills of trauma-informed practice in November. And then in 2021, we'll continue with webinars on working with parents who have had their children removed, overcoming communication challenges to engage children, and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children. Now, for those of you who might not be familiar with this platform, you can access the chat box by clicking on the purple button. If you have a question for the panel, you can submit it via the blue hand button. You can download slides and resources, including our case study and our panelist bios, by clicking on the light blue button at the top of your screen. To refresh the webinar, just click on the green button with the circled arrow. And if you're having technical difficulties, you can message Redback directly by clicking on the help button, or you can call them on 1800 733 416. Now, learning outcomes for tonight. At the end of tonight's webinar, we'd like you to be able to outline how to make children and parents more active within professional practice and how to privilege the skills and know-how of children and parents. To illustrate examples of conversations with parents and children that pave the way for relationships that are collaborative, accountable, and honouring of children's voices. To discuss how practitioners and parents' perspectives need to shift to become more child-led, and to illustrate examples of the skills that practitioners can use to help children become more comfortable within a professional setting. So you would have received a copy of our panelist bios with your webinar invitation. You can also download a copy by clicking on the light blue resources button I mentioned just before. Tonight we're joined by three excellent panellists who I'd love to introduce you to, maybe starting with Mr. Jason Main, our child and family partner from Tasmania. Jason, as a child and family partner, what have you found important in your engagement with professionals?
Just to be honest with them, basically, you know, because there's no point, you know, having like, you know, playing the blame game. In my experience, it's been better for you to be honest with parents up front about what to expect and what they expect and what's achievable.
Definitely. Thanks, Jason. Our next panellist is Olivia Clayton, a clinical psychologist from Victoria. Olivia, one of your roles is as a practice design specialist at the Parenting Research Centre. How does this role inform your clinical work with parents and children?
Yeah, well, for those who don't know the PRC, it's a not-for-profit independent which seeks to support children to thrive by driving new and better ways to support families in their parenting. And there we've spent a lot of time in the space of developing practice framework for organisations to use in their work with families. So the how-tos of being collaborative, but specific to particular services. So I guess how that informs my clinical work is that I get to use the practices which we develop, and I get to test them out a bit and know how it feels to be the clinician. And I would say that, really as a result, the idea of bringing a collaborative partnership approach to my work in the clinic is right up there, top of mind in everything that I say and do. And I'll just say I'm a psychologist, not a clinical psychologist, just a psychologist.
Sorry.
That's all right.
Cool. Thanks, Olivia. And finally, we're also joined by Dr. Melinda Goodyear, a researcher with Emerging Minds based in Victoria. As a researcher, Melinda, you specialise in exploring vulnerability and resilience in families with complex needs. What are some of the key messages you've discovered so far through this work?
Thanks, Jackie. In the space where I've been in, it's really mainly families where there's vulnerability, I guess, to children's mental health, so parental mental illness, substance abuse, trauma, those sort of things. And there's some commonalities there across those families, and there's a lot of crossover as well. And I guess what the key messages are is that often these issues are intergenerational. So often they'll have experiences, parents will have experiences like the children are having experiences now. And really thinking about breaking that cycle, it really needs to be a whole of family approach. One of the things that I find a lot in my work is the sense of shame and stigma in these families. And you really have to hold that in mind when you are talking to children and parents in these families. And I guess the main message really is that most parents and children are doing their best given the situation that they're in. They're often lacking the resources of other families, I guess, and it can be really powerful for these families to just acknowledge that they're actually doing okay and that they have the ability to achieve their wishes and goals, I guess. And it's really a very important step breaking away from that disempowerment I think I'm finding that these families are experiencing.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks, Melinda. So tonight's webinar is centered around our case study featuring Zach and Helen. Helen has paid a visit to her GP to ask for her son Zach's ADHD medication to be increased, as he has been acting out more recently and she's struggling to cope. Helen has recently separated from her partner, Michael, who had used his relationship with Zach and Zach's brother to conceal his gambling debts. I'd now like to invite Jason to kick off the first part of tonight's presentation and give us an insight into what the family might be feeling in this situation. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you. Okay, so when meeting with Helen about her concerns with Zach, I think it's important that the practitioner explores the family's circumstances. So don't just rely on the referral description. In my experience, discussing the family dynamics and issues surrounding the problems often allows for a broader discussion. So it's important to acknowledge Helen's concerns, but it's equally important to go deeper. So obviously you want to know, what has Helen noticed about Zach's behaviour? When did it start? Those sorts of things, because you want to get a fuller picture. And at this point in time, it's only Helen that you're getting the story from. So you need to get as much information there as possible rather than just diving in on prescribing the ADHD medication or whatever. So it's important to acknowledge Helen's concerns and find out what it is that's really bothering her about that behaviour. So what we want to do is encourage Helen to think about Zach's feelings. Obviously, there have been some big changes going on in Helen and Zach's lives, and how Helen's relationship ended with Michael has had a big impact on Zach. But Helen's very angry. She's upset. And it's important for her to think not only about her reactions, but to also understand that Zach is upset too. What I've found is sometimes as a parent, we forget about how events that occur in our lives impact on the children because we're too caught up in our own thoughts. So in Zach and Helen's case, what you would want to do is find out more about what, you know, what Helen thinks. How's life been for Zach? Particularly, so, you know, a good question to ask is when did this behaviour begin, and then tying that back perhaps if she says, look, 3 weeks ago when Michael left, then we've got something to correlate between, okay, well, Zach's been acting up since then, so maybe there's something going on there that they haven't really been discussing between them. And we want to find out how that's impacting Helen's parenting. Through the case study, she's quite angry with Zach and his behaviour. But we want to encourage Helen to respond to Zach in a positive way and not in a negative way, because that's not very helpful, obviously. So I think it's relevant that Helen has asked about Zach's feelings, when the behaviour started and why it may have begun to deteriorate. Ideally, you want to tap into her love for Zach and for other children and ask her to consider their emotional state. Perhaps Helen can ask Zach what's troubling him, rather than making assumptions that he's just being naughty or, you know, having a problem with his medication. And what we want to do is, you know, find out how he felt about Michael leaving, and how can Helen help Zach get through this. Helen could ask him if he'd be interested in talking to someone who could help, and this serves as a way that Helen can show that she's concerned for Zach and wants him to be able to access help as well. I believe it's important that Zach is given a voice. That's absolutely the most important thing of all, is that the child gets a voice. Very often they don't, and the parent, for whatever reason, doesn't disclose what's going on, and you know, the child seems to get lost in the background. So you want to find out his feelings, his experiences are very important to hear and include in the conversation, and find out his perspective. And Zach is likely to think he's a bad person, that he's, you know, that he's in trouble. And we want to find ways to reinforce to him that he's not a bad kid and that what has happened is not his fault. So whatever the format is, it's vitally important to work together so that both Zach and Helen feel included, coming up to a way forward that works for everyone. With Helen learning about Zach's feelings and insecurities, and Zach understanding his mother is stressed and upset, that there is room for mutual understanding and compromise. Finally, really important, all parents at some point or another need support. So we want to find out who is Helen's support network. She got friends, family, or other health professionals. So it's important to discuss with Helen about her need for support, even if it's just a cup of tea with a friend, or it's better for Helen to talk to someone rather than keep it all bottled up and not discuss it with anyone at all. So explore some options with her so that she's aware that it's not just about Zach, it's also about her health too.
Great. Thanks, Jason. That was awesome. Some really great insights into the family's perspective. I'd now like to invite Olivia to share a psychologist's perspective of the case.
Thanks, Jackie. I'm going to talk about my likely approach here as a private psychologist who Mum has come to see with Zach. And my input into this webinar is informed by, you know, both experience as a private psychologist and also my years of work in practice design and research at the Parenting Research Centre. So collaborative practice with families or working with parents is seen as so important because of the decades now of research around the importance of the parent-child relationship. We know, of course, that the parent-child relationship impacts children's outcomes and outcomes in learning, in development, in health and well-being. And in fact, it's the quality of the parent-child relationship, so how warm and responsive our parents are when we are children and when we are babies, that has been shown to shape the way our brain develops. So the question for me when Helen's sitting with me perhaps for a first session is, you know, how do I get Helen to see it as a family issue and not just a child issue? And the way that I would approach my work with her is founded on the idea that building the capacity of adults to care for children, so the ones who are there 24/7, is the most powerful way to promote their development. So I'm going to be coming from an approach of family-centred practice and the Bronfenbrenner model. But really what I'm going to be doing is working hard to help her understand the powerful role that she does play in shaping her child's development. I'll be seeking to bring her on board as the key change agent in Zach's life. So I'll help her self-regulate and help her experience that she can support change in his behaviour alongside the important role that the Ritalin may be playing. But first I wanted to highlight just some observations I would make about mum right up front, probably, as I'm talking with her in that first session. And I'm working on my relationship with her during this, and I'm empathising, but I'm also observing a few things based on that YouTube clip. So she might feel like she's at full capacity right now, and in fact she currently has no room for taking on new parenting strategies. She presents as highly stressed, like Jason pointed out. She's angry, she's shaky, she's tense and she's snappy. She may be under financial pressure too, you know, due to the ex-partner's gambling. So can she afford the basics? Does she feel safe and secure? And does mum have a support network? Does she have time for things like self-care? In some of the things she says, there's a few assumptions that she's making which are intriguing. So she talks about the departure of Michael, her partner, as perhaps not having a negative impact on Zach. And I've also got some questions about her knowledge of ADHD when she says things like, I read children can grow out of their ADHD medication. And finally, her focus on misbehaviour. She says, he's being a proper little prick at the moment. And that type of comment to me, a common comment really, but it indicates that she sometimes falls into the common trap of labelling the child rather than the behaviour. So that would be just a little note for work in the future that I might remember there when she says that. But it also speaks to the stress she's under. And we'll want to get very clear about what the behaviour is, but also acknowledge that it's so easy to fall into the trap of focusing on your child's misbehaviour. We don't know what being a little prick is yet, but it might be a behaviour which is very difficult to ignore. And it might be getting him the kind of attention, the kind of immediate and highly fired up type of attention from mum. But because she's under such major stress herself, it actually becomes the majority of the attention that he does get from her. So down the track, it might be important for Helen to get to a point where she can ask herself whether she spends more of her time noticing and attending to that positive behaviour or his misbehaviour, but that would come later. I just wanted to spend, I guess, a few minutes talking about working with parents in general and acknowledging that, you know, working with parents can be really challenging. So I'm sure many of us could share stories of when things, you know, didn't go so well as what we would have liked in our work with parents, even with our best intentions. And in private practice, of course, parents vote with their feet. So we would say, though, that it is with families who are facing really complex challenges in their parenting that can benefit most from our support and most from a strong collaborative partnership approach. And to do that, to take a strong collaborative partnership approach, it's important to understand social and psychological barriers to parents seeking help. So to work effectively with parents, you know, we need to understand where they're coming from. We need to be compassionate towards parents and their issues and their concerns and have a realistic understanding of parenting, the psychology and the social context of parenting, because then this context shapes and provides understanding about why parents may do and say the things that they say or do. And at the foundation of the collaborative approach with families, it's a recognition that today's parents are exposed to and constantly feel a high level of scrutiny and blame. So they feel judged already when they come to you. So my perspective tonight is about the importance that the collaborative stance has in helping Helen make the big shift to seeing herself as part of the solution here. And coming from a collaborative stance means that we're thinking about parents as not the cause of their children's problems, but as a major part of the solution, because we know that issues in children's development and well-being have multiple causes, and blaming parents is not only simplistic, but it's unhelpful. And it means having the view that parents are doing their best, sometimes under difficult circumstances, and that difficulties are not due to lack of caring or flawed character or a moral failing. And in fact, you'll probably not find a parent who says, "I don't want to be a good parent." And we need to view unhelpful and even potentially damaging things that parents do in light of, you know, the individual and the context that they're in. So adopting a non-judgmental and accepting attitude with parents is critical to effective collaboration. We won't always agree with the parent, but we always need to work to understand why the parent's behaving the way they are. So the collaborative practitioner assumes that families, even families that appear to be really struggling, bring a range of competencies to the table that can be identified and used and grown. And that third point there is about knowing that effective parenting comes in all shapes and sizes. So it's better to focus on the function rather than the form when it comes to parenting behaviours. And there are many ways that parents can achieve essential elements of effective parenting, and these ways are shaped by culture and experience. So, for example, of course, the way affection is communicated can look very different family to family, culture to culture, different cultures. So finally, the collaborative stance is about knowing that parenting is learned and learnable. That's key. So the way that someone parents is influenced by their own history of being parented as a child, their culture and beliefs, and a range of other factors. However, the most important factor shaping parenting is experience. So parenting is mainly learned on the job through the process of parenting and interacting with a child. And as such, we know it is possible to deliberately develop and refine parenting skills through trial and error and support and practice. So that ends the summary of my approach. Thanks, Jackie.
Great. Thanks, Olivia. There were so many great insights there, and I look forward to unpacking them more in the Q&A part of tonight's session. Finally, I'd like to invite Melinda to take us through the researcher's perspective on tonight's case study.
Yeah, thanks, Jackie. And I guess I come at this talk from studying a number of programs and looking at some of the core elements of some of the programs that are out there to support professionals working with parents and also children. And through this part of the presentation, I really want to highlight how do we capture the child's experience. So I guess the case study for me really highlighted, yes, it's a complex context, but all the players in that actually can have different contexts and have different views or contexts influencing their views. So there's Helen and her context, but there's also the doctor, the practitioner that Olivia was talking, they're looking for things as well to try to work out what's going on. And they're not necessarily passive in the relationship. And in fact, Olivia was talking about the importance of collaboration, and that's one of the things that's coming out, that collaborative practice is a great way to go in these tricky conversations. And there's also the context for Zach. But in the video, it was very difficult to know what Zach's voice was and how we capture that. So I want to talk a little bit about that moving forward. But at the moment in that room, there's really only Helen and the doctor. And at that point, there are some things that you can do to bring Zach into that conversation. So it's really about trying to understand or trying to help Helen understand Zach's context. A great way to start is actually, not delving into the tricky conversation straight away. Start with Zach's daily life. What is Zach's daily life like? And some studies have really found this is really helpful because you'll get information, I guess, about the child's ecology, other contributing factors, and it helps Helen see the circumstances that Zach is in. Oops. So if there's time, a doctor-parent relationship, they're quite short, but there are some programs out there, and Emerging Minds does do training in a program called Let's Talk About Children. And there's also a PERCS conversation guide that you can find through other e-learning programs that they have. And they really talk about an approach to have that initial conversation with Helen. So asking Helen what's working well, what's not going so well for Zach, what's important, talking to Helen about taking the perspective of Zach, I guess. What's important? What does he seem to enjoy? What makes him happy? And how's he managing his emotions? How does he manage to calm down when upset? But also thinking about his world, I guess. So what are the places that he's going to? What are the activities that he's going, that he likes doing? And what are these people in his life? And really we find that quite a helpful way to kind of see Zach's strengths, I guess, and the strengths in the family, but also the vulnerabilities that might be there. You can also see the significant relationships in his life and also start to get a picture of the support network, both for Zach and also for Helen as well. And we often talk about how doing this from a collaborative, strength-based approach. And really, it's a really great opportunity to point out some of the things that are going really well. It's not some work out of Finland's really talking about strengths not being the ultimate thing that someone's doing. It's what's working for them. That's a strength in their family. And some other work has sort of talked about vulnerabilities with really helps that conversation go well with a parent, that they're open to talking about vulnerabilities and in the picture of the strengths that they've got. They want a true picture of what's going on for them. It's another important thing to think about how we help Helen realise her parenting, I guess, values and goals. So what might Helen want to change from her perspective? What might she want for Zach as well? And that way you can start to work with Helen around some of those goals. And you can see that a lot of stuff that tends to come out in this is that these parents that are struggling want the best for their children. Now, they've said things like, I don't want my child to have the same experience I've had. So you can really get into what their goal is around seeing the child beyond its behaviour, I guess. So the child voice. So there's a fair bit of work on the child voice, particularly in healthcare settings. How do we include the children in consultations, in paediatric consultations, for instance? You know, it's quite renowned that children are invisible in some of these conversations, and often the views of these children are through adult lenses, I guess. We're viewing them through our own context. But how we talk to children, it is really important to consider the developmental stage. In preschool, it's said that they're a bit more suggestible. So thinking about giving them options in response to a question, so giving a range or things like that. In middle childhood and early adolescence, they're starting to really get that peer identification. They're starting to maybe withdraw a little bit from adults. So they're really suggesting a casual and accepting attitude. Middle adolescence, they're really saying that they'll respond well to conversations where you are almost talking on the same level, like a sort of equal level with them. I guess from the case study, it could also be an opportunity for Zach to contribute to what the issue is for him. And in doing so, if we can open a conversation, if the next appointment brings him to that situation, it can really be a good way to build his competence, literacy, and also it can build the communication strategies, not only in Zach in naming some of these things, but help the family start to discuss these. Because really these principles of self-determination, supporting the strengths in a parent, making them feel competent in their parenting, can also apply to children as well, and develop that shared understanding. So how do we identify the children's own point of view? The research is sort of suggesting that it's a good way to kind of start by asking the child's permission to have that conversation. So get their consent, or if they're younger than 18, it's called their assent. And it's really important to explain what the session is about to them and what is expected, what's going to happen, what are the expectations in the session. Think about ways that you can build trust and rapport in the beginning of that conversation. A lot of people start with activities particularly around the child's interests. And also things that are really important to think about is the social and cultural context in which those children live, because that influences their knowledge and also their views. And things like thinking about family of origin, family of origin of their parents, but family of procreation, cultural issues, spirituality or cultural differences, and even family beliefs. So what we do know is families develop a sense of family identity and their own beliefs that carries through the generations. And I guess to sort of say what's important in these conversations is thinking of ways to empower children to contribute. So seeing their strengths, acknowledging their hopes. Often children in families where a parent has a mental illness may be quite protective of their parents as well and find it difficult to say difficult things about their parent. And it is okay to validate that they may want to protect their parent in this circumstance. And I've found that really helpful for children to feel it's okay to then open up about that. And the other thing that the research is saying, it's really important that you check for understanding. So check that your view of what the child's saying to you is a correct view from their perspective. So checking on their ideas, actions and experiences. And finally, this comes from some research. A lot of research has been done in that paediatric health outpatient setting. And these are some of the suggestions for how to actually include the child in a consultation. They talk a lot about this idea of talking to the child at eye level. And that's like thinking about how you present to the child, how you thinking about the potential power differentials that are actually in the room, thinking about setting up the physical setting so that it's supportive or familiar to a child. The other thing is to think about whether it needs who needs to be in the room with the child. Younger children prefer their parents to be there. Older children prefer to be usually independent. Think about the child's privacy, particularly when you're online and things like that. Start with a non-threatening topic and listen actively. Your body language is really important and tone of voice. And this becomes even more important in an online setting as well. And think of creative ways that you can communicate with children. Think about using pictures, picture cards. Think about different ways that they may describe things to you. So three wishes or using a magic wand to change something, what would that be? In a sort of developmentally appropriate way. And I guess the last tip is really about if it is tricky, and it has been that way, if it is tricky having this conversation, you sometimes can elicit fears and concerns by reference to others. So sometimes I'll have a conversation about other kids, sometimes in your situation, experience these kind of things as well. And that helps them not only normalise, but also helps them bring up some of these tricky things that they think you might react to. Yeah. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Mel. That was awesome. Thank you to all of our presenters, really. I'm sure the audience would agree that all three presentations were really fascinating and comprehensive. And just quickly, thank you to the 1,012 of you who are now currently tuning in. And to everyone who's already submitted a question for our panelists, just a reminder that you can submit a question by clicking on the blue button at the top of your screen. So for the next half hour or so, we're going to aim to answer some of those questions for you. I might start off with Olivia. How do you develop a collaborative partnership in your practice with parents?
Thanks, Jackie. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So I think that the way that I develop a collaborative partnership in my approach with parents is really about looking to partner to achieve the change together with the child. But there's distinct roles there in the partnership. So the parent brings the in-depth knowledge about their child and their family, their culture and their background. They're the specialist, if you like, in their child or the expert on their child. And I, as a psychologist, would look to bring some knowledge which comes from research and from experience of working with many families, and particularly knowledge here about child development. You know, whether Zach is just expressing his feelings are fairly typical in terms of his age, or whether it is something that is, you know, should be classified as something that's problematic is probably something to explore there in terms of what's typical development for an eight-year-old boy when things go wrong and they tend to blame themselves. Particularly though, my role would be about supporting Helen in our partnership to support the change in her child. So helping her use that knowledge of child development and use and take what we know from work with families and research on that that could be useful to her and adapt and apply it to her situation. So I guess in a practical sense, the collaborative practitioner is always clear that they're not the one making the decisions. So the parent is making the decisions and we bring some ideas. And the collaborative practitioner always stops short of telling the parent what to do. So you make it really clear, and you do that by asking things like, you know, at the end of the session, so what do you think you'll do based on this information, or what have you decided to do now? And that makes it really clear to the parent that they're the key decision maker.
Great. Thanks, Olivia. Continuing on the topic of sort of partnerships between practitioner and parent, Jason, I wondered how a practitioner might help you to feel empowered in your role as a parent and why you think it's important that they do.
Basically, I think letting the parent know that they're let the parent know that they're the expert with their children. They know their children best. They know what's going on at home. They know all the situations. So just letting the parent know that is quite empowering for a practitioner to tell me that, you know, well, you're the expert. You know, tell me what's going on. How do you see this? It is empowering, and it gives you a sense of confidence in yourself as well, because it builds confidence. And I think it's important to do that because it can make a big difference to your own outlook as a parent. Just looking into that and saying, okay, well, they're asking me, so that, you know, obviously I have got some sort of skills, or I have, you know, I've got something to offer, and I think that's really important. Yep.
Definitely. Thanks, Jason. We have a question from Georgina, which I might throw to you, Melinda. In circumstances where one party, usually the young person, is unwilling or unable to respond or contribute or maybe even attend sessions, how can you ensure that their voice is still captured?
It's a great question. And it does always feel like if you don't have the child there, then how are you going to include their voice? But there are some, I guess, creative ways that you can do that. But first, I should probably say I would be interested to know why the child isn't there, or whether they have said that they don't want to be there. And some of that can be a bit of a misunderstanding about the expectations in the session as well. So it's really important to clarify with the child somehow that they understand your role. It's also good to work through the parent. This can be really powerful in a family, is work through the parent to understand the child's voice. This not only raises awareness in a parent, but it also helps get the child's voice into the room if they're not there. And I'd probably say the third way is really thinking about, ways that, I mean, talking about the child's daily life is really helpful. It points out routines. It points out activities that are important. It points out if there's struggles getting to school, if there's no lunches, if there's issues with behaviour and the relationship. And so it's a good way to do it. But also I'd say that there are other ways. I've seen people use things like letters or pictures. So asking the child to draw a picture, asking the child to take some video around, you know, we do some work around the social support network around a child, and we ask them to draw the people in their lives. And we can do that activity in person, asking them, but also it can be done through pictures, through video, through photos, and really thinking about creative ways that you can tap into that child's perspective, I guess. And people do recommend that you focus on the child's interests as well to do that, to get them to come into the room as well. Yep. Thanks, Jessie.
Great. Thanks, Melinda. Sort of as a follow-up to that, just quickly, Claire has asked, when giving a child a voice, particularly preschool children, how do you make sure that your practices for giving them a voice aren't suggestive in any way?
Yeah. So that's really good, because that is one of the issues with younger children. And I think I might have touched on it before. They recommend thinking about giving children options to decide the answer to the question, if that makes any sense. So sort of, or a range that they can respond to, rather than asking a direct question. Or it's thinking about the way that you can involve their decision making, I guess. And that suggestibility is a real issue for young children. But one of the other ways that's really effective is play-based activities. It's said to be a really important part of that. A lot of the younger children also have their parents present, and it is really important to think about, you know, if there are tricky issues in the family, whether the parent being present is the right thing as well, but that can be tricky with issues as well. So there's a whole bunch of things that you probably could do, but the suggestion is mainly play and think about the way you're framing the question to the child, where they can choose an answer rather than just agree with you or not. Does that make
sense?
Definitely.
Yeah, I think so. Hopefully Claire agrees. Thank you. Damien has asked just around how you might involve the child's teacher in a situation like this. Jason, would you like to take that one?
Yeah, sure. I think it's extremely helpful for to get the perspective of a teacher or teachers, especially if the child is of school age and they're not within your scope of what's happening during the day. You might be at work or at home or wherever. You're not seeing what's going on during the school hours, and the teacher might have insight into some behaviours, you know, if there's bullying, if there's distraction in the classroom, if there's problems with learning. So I think if you can get the teacher's input, you know, that might just be through a letter to the psychologist or to the practitioner, just, you know, giving some idea, you know, giving some input into that situation. I think that would be really helpful. Yeah.
Definitely. Thank you, Jason. Now, Olivia, I might just go back to you for a second, if that's okay. Kerry would love to know what sort of evidence-based approaches or therapies you might use in this situation.
Yeah, sure. I'm certainly, my mind goes straight to some really good strategies that would involve, you know, positive parenting behaviour support, and also, you know, a mix really for Helen in particular around supporting her to understand her thoughts and reactions to Zach's behaviour by utilising ACT principles, CBT as well. You know, those two could be very complementary to each other, helping her recognise unhelpful thinking styles, and then also, you know, notice and accept when her thoughts come up, and help her develop an awareness so that they don't have such a great impact on her own stress, and then perhaps her behaviour, her choices in her behaviour towards responding to Zach's behaviour as well. But yeah, certainly, you know, the parenting style work, the work in helping parents understand the importance that their attention can play in the parent-child relationship that they have, and how that actually they can really positively use that attention if they have particular behaviours that they want to increase, being able to, you know, give their child positive attention during those times. So that sort of stuff is based on a lot of, yeah, people's work over the years. Mark Dadds is a great one there to look into.
Cool, thanks. I might throw this question from Lucy open to the panel. Lucy says she works as a school counsellor with primary and high school children and has very limited contact with the parents, usually just a 30 to 60 minute parent interview prior to starting 6 to 12 individual sessions of counselling with the child. So she's wondering if you have any advice on how to emphasise the need for changes at home on top of individual counselling for the child, or how you might encourage the parents to seek extra support like family counselling or parenting programs.
Who wants to take that one? Do you want to take it first, Olivia?
Yeah, I could take that. I think that's a really, really tricky and common situation that people find themselves in. You know, as a practitioner, you only have relatively brief interactions with the family and you have no control over the environment. So the challenge becomes, you know, how do you make just that snippet of time that you do have help the parent actually change something, you know? And that's really about coming to every conversation that you might have with that parent with an understanding that you're potentially asking them to change something. And that's about understanding, you know, adult behaviour change. So for me, I guess it comes back to the attitude in everything that you say in that conversation with the parent. So in the way that you're talking, you're thinking about parenting as being a part of the solution and not the cause. And you're thinking that, you're treading very carefully. There's I guess a consciousness that you have, that you're building the relationship with this person in everything that you say and do. You know, the partnership that you'll have with them is going to be so important for helping that parent make any sort of change.
I can follow that up, Olivia, that there is some interesting work that is happening. It's overseas at the moment, but they're thinking of bringing it to Australia where there's a conversation, I guess, between the teacher or a person, a counsellor in a school with the parent, where the essence of it is that you're both partners in supporting this child. Does that sort of make sense? So you both come together and can contribute to those questions around what the child's like at home and what the child's like at school. And it sort of is a way, it's a 1-to-2 session program. It's let's talk, but it's for schools. And it's becoming quite effective because what it does is break down that, it really breaks down the hierarchy between the parent and the teacher or the person from school and or the counsellor, and it sort of gets them on the same page, I guess, around a goal of supporting this child. And so together they can talk about the things that they can do when they're with the child to help them, and it becomes more of a solid partnership. And that's shown to be quite effective at the moment. So that'd be a good thing to look into, I guess, in how maybe we can do some more work with that at Emerging Minds as well.
Great. Thank you, guys. I should check, Jason, did you have anything that you wanted to add to that? Or
I think, you know, with school counsellors and things like that, they do have very limited time to speak to you. And I guess my thing would be to have those resources if you have, like, you know, say a link to Emerging Minds or somewhere like that, or links to or resources that you can give to the parent and, you know, in the discussion and say, you know, this is something we could look at together. And that way, you know, you can start a conversation around that and then, you know, carry that forward later on.
Mm.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you, Jason. Question from a few of our audience members tonight. I might throw to you, Olivia. you describe how you would work with a parent who is resistant? So perhaps someone who just wants you to come in and fix their child who and isn't really interested in sort of delving into the underlying causes of that behaviour. How would you work with a parent like that, and how might you help them to understand the role that they play in supporting their child's mental health?
Thanks, Jackie. Yeah, that's a really big question. It's a good one too. And, you know, for me, or for the, you know, the collaborative approach here, when it comes to resistance, it's about finding a way to explore that resistance. And to do that, it comes back to acknowledging that there's, you know, there's so much judgment of parents out there that actually I'd be surprised, you know, pleasantly surprised, if a parent ever came in seeing me not exhibiting some sort of, you know, resistance. And just to expand on that a little bit further, you know, parents feel judged because, you know, every week in the media there's something new that would suggest that parents have done something wrong. You know, social media commentary in particular can be brutal. And even when adults make mistakes, the public discourse would often, you know, shift back to, well, you know, what happened when they were children? What did their parents do or not do that led to them making decisions that they've made as adults? And then wearing judgment is this sort of everyday experience of parents as well. You know, in the supermarket, you know, are people thinking, why are you bringing your child in here when we're in the middle of a pandemic? Or, you know, you're scootering down the road with your children and someone's, you know, pointing out to you, hey, that, you know, you should be telling your child to have a look at driveways, they might get run over. So whenever children are being children and not following instructions, parents are feeling judged. And they also have to constantly wear the judgment of others they know too, such as family members, you know, who offer their well-intended advice about what they should do differently. You know, grandma, you should back off a bit and just let him be a kid. Or grandpa, you should put better boundaries in place. You know, he needs to know what the boundaries are. So parents often come to you, understandably resistant would be my approach. And that's because of this certain type of baggage that we all carry being parents and constantly feeling like we might be being judged. So helping a parent like Helen understand, you know, the role that she plays in supporting her child's mental health is an approach where the relationship between the two of you is the key thing. So she needs to trust you because in fact, you'll be supporting her to make, you know, changes in the way that she's doing things. You know, that being said, also it's worth noting that, you know, change is really hard for people and people, you should expect people to appear resistant if they're thinking that you're going to expect them to be making some changes. And that's normal. You know, changing habits is hard. And we all know that if you've tried to, you know, hit a new weight loss goal or cut down on alcohol or of course, develop a new skill, it requires a lot of effort. And changing your usual way of doing things or your modus operandi on how you respond to your children, it involves some thinking, some discomfort. And the human brain likes to feel assured and safe and in control, but changing your parenting is asking you to take a bit of a step into the unknown. You know, even asking someone like Helen to change what we might think is a small thing. So, you know, asking her to notice, you know, asking her to use something like labelled praise. So asking that's requiring her to change, to notice when Zach's behaving in a way that she likes and praise him. That might be quite a shift for her. You know, she might have to overcome an ingrained habit of actually looking out for or being vigilant to the negative behaviour. And she'll need to do perhaps a 180 there to see and be vigilant instead for the positive behaviour. And she'll need to know what she's looking for. And then once she sees it, she'll have to do a whole new thing, you know, perhaps stopping what she's doing getting up nice and close to him and coming up with the right words, which are genuine and enthusiastic. So I think when thinking about clients appearing resistant, it's about treading really carefully, because change is really hard. There's one thing to come to a psychologist with a problem, you know, an irritant in your life, and you want something to be different, and quite another thing then taking on the new skills and a change, which will mean that you can deal with the issue. So that's what a parent might be appearing unsure or resistant about. I hope that answers.
That's such a good answer.
Can I follow that up?
Can
I follow that up a little bit?
Is
that all right?
Yeah.
I wanted to say that's great. And Olivia, that's really great that there's the behavioural sort of things that the parent can do to really switch that around, and that's really helpful. We've also found that going with that, and you'll probably say something about this, is if you can connect it somehow to the parent's values or wishes for their child as well, or goals for their child, that sometimes that's really helpful in driving the behaviour change. And seeing, for instance, Helen, seeing how the child is dealing with their emotions and things that they can do to, or they're not feeling good about themselves, and things that she can do to make a difference in her child's life, can be very fulfilling for Helen, because it's helping Helen achieve her goals around her parenting as well. I guess that's what I wanted to say. So I don't know if you want to say about that, Olivia, whether that's part of it as well.
Yeah, entirely part of it. The idea of, you know, setting, helping Helen set a goal that is meaningful to her is going to be tying it back to her values as a parent, you know, and probably
yeah.
something that she hasn't had someone ask her about before. And that can be, yeah, truly, truly powerful and motivating to for an individual to develop a goal that is in line with their true values as a parent.
I'd have to agree with that as well. You want to be able to do the best you can as a parent, because it's a tough gig, and when you do get that that feedback to you, you want to set up some goals for yourself and for your children, I think that's really important as well. So I will agree with that, yeah.
Thanks everyone. Just a quick follow-up question I had for you, Jason, was around how practitioners can engage with parents in a way that they don't feel judged or blamed for the child's difficulties.
Yeah, I think with that, it is hard, I guess. In my experience, the practitioners that I've worked with have been very welcoming, they've been very open. But when you know that, you know, it's not going to be scary or anything like that, you know, they're quite gentle with you. And I think that's the thing, is just building up a nice rapport with the parent, and getting them to understand that, you know, there are outside pressures like social media and all that sort of thing out there, but that the practitioner is there to help you, and you're there to help your child, and, you know, it all works together. So, yeah, absolutely. I think being gentle and being honest and open and, yeah, that would work really well. It works for me, so, yeah.
Yeah. That's great.
I could add to that too, Jackie, just exactly those things. And also I think important is the idea that as a practitioner, you're coming from a real place of curiosity in understanding mm-hmm. the parents. So you're interested in learning about them and why, what they've tried, why they're doing what they're doing now, and, you know, what's working and what's not working, and really looking for the positive intention behind what they're doing. And just one other thing.
Yeah, sorry, Olivia, go.
All right. Just further to that is, you know, it's so important, like Jason was saying, to convey this sort of this warmth. And also I think parents often really just need to be listened to. So parents can be really empowered by being listened to in a genuine way. And, you know, you're listening to what they're saying, you're tuning into what they're saying and what they're feeling. So you're getting the information that you need, but you're also building a relationship with them by doing that.
And just to follow that up, there are some little tricks to that, I guess. There's some, and thinking about what you're noticing, but thinking about reflections with the parents or summarising what they're saying to you or providing some affirmations, even that it's normal to be worried about certain things for their children, or it's normal to find parenting a very hard gig. And some of those statements are really important because they send a message to the parent that you are listening to them and you have heard them. And I think that's a really important part of the process as well. Basically what Olivia said.
Definitely. Jill, Brenda and Elsa have all picked up on the fact that grief and loss are probably playing a part in Zach and Helen's situation as well. You know, Zach's lost his attachment father figure whom he had a pretty good relationship with. Helen has lost her partner and she's feeling kind of betrayed as well. So they would like to know how you as a practitioner, anyone who would like to answer, how you might acknowledge these experiences during the support and therapy, and also how you might help Helen and Zach to understand what normal responses to grief are and what might be sort of more concern.
I could start here. I think that is truly very important and at the heart of this case. It would undoubtedly involve initially some helping build awareness in Helen, and that actually this is a change. This is a grief process that she's going through at the moment. You know, she's seen it as something necessary that she had to do. It was a decision that she made for the better of to better their lives. However, it will be a long adjustment time for her. So, yeah, talking very, openly and helping her understand and educate her, really, that separation and adjustment and big changes like this are big for ourselves and also really big for our children, giving her some insights into that.
So, Olivia, is that sort of around meaning-making, helping them make meaning for what's happening to them at the moment? And I also wonder if there's some sort of stories or books that Helen could use with Zach. I don't really know any, but, to create that conversation that it is a normal response, I guess. Yeah.
Yes.
Great. Thanks, guys. It's about time for us to wrap up. Just very quickly, Melinda, Kathy has asked what the name of the program you mentioned in schools was.
It's called Let's Talk About Children, but there is the program available at Emerging Minds for Professionals. And so there's a little bit of an extension one that's happened in a few countries in Europe where the teacher is part of the conversation in talking about the daily life of the child, like the parent does, because they each have a role in that child's development, I guess. And it could be transferred to a counsellor as well. And so if you can look at Let's Talk About Children, you can see how the model could be done with a parent, but also another caregiver or another person that you want to build a partnership with around that child.
Great. Thanks, Mel. Melinda, sorry.
No, it's good.
Thank you, everyone, for all of your incredible questions. I'm sorry that we've only been able to scratch the surface of them. But I just wanted to, first of all, thank all of tonight's panelists. You've all been incredible. There have been some really excellent insights and practical strategies for ways to work more collaboratively with children and families. And I hope our audience has found some useful takeaways for their own practice. Just quickly, I'd like to invite each of you to sum up your reflections in a couple of minutes, perhaps starting with you, Jason.
Basically just thinking along the lines of just building that rapport and building those relationships and making sure that the voice of the child is heard. I think they're really big takeaways, and also giving the parents the tools to care for themselves as well as the children. Yep.
Great. Thank you. Olivia?
Sure. I would say that, you know, a genuinely effective relationship is the essential component to building an adult's capacity for changing their parenting. And that, you know, collaboration with a parent is 90% about attitude. You know, you have to genuinely believe that collaboration is necessary. You can't fake it. You have to believe that together it's a team effort to get to a better outcome, and that parents will have their antenna out for blame. So they'll be sensitive for blame, and they'll detect it even if you do hold judgment, if you do hold judgments about them. You know, you have to be non-judgmental. You have to think the parents are doing their best and they're not having difficulties because of a failing. And more often than not, it's about external circumstances or complexities that their child brings that are making things more difficult at the current time. And just also finally about the collaborative partnership, you know, you don't have to be an expert or a guru. Mm. You know, you're there because you believe you can help with a fresh perspective. So.
Thank you. And finally, Melinda.
Yeah, I guess the others have said what I was going to say, I guess, but I should also say that really supporting that parents and children are experts in their own lives, and creating ways for them in the conversation to give you their perspective and their wishes and their goals and their ideas for who they want to be as children and parents, and to think about the fact that children are commonly invisible, I guess, in some of the issues that parents are facing, but they are witness to it all. And there's numerous children that know exactly what's going on in the home, but the parents think they're hiding things, particularly substance use and things like that as well. So, and what tends to happen is the children make up their own meaning out of that situation, or their own meaning. And a lot of children can say that they blame themselves for what's going on in the home, or their parent being upset. So it's really important to open up the parent's perspective on the child, but also, and talk about their struggles, but also the child's experience of it as well, and help the family come to a shared meaning or shared understanding of the situation as well.
Definitely. Thank you, Melinda. So as well as tonight's presentation slides and case study, you'll find a bunch of supporting resources curated by our panellists in the supporting resources tab, which is the light blue button at the top of your screen. And if you'd like more information about Emerging Minds or to check out our library of free e-learning courses and resources, just head to www.emergingminds.com.au. Again, we have two more webinars coming up before the end of the year, and we'd love to see you at the next session, Engaging Fathers and Their Children, on the 29th of October, which will be facilitated by my colleague and familiar face, Dan Moss. We'd also really appreciate if you could take a couple of minutes to complete our exit survey and provide feedback to help us improve these webinar series. You can access the survey by clicking on the yellow icon in the top right of your screen. You should all receive your statement of attendance for tonight's webinar in about 4 weeks' time, and you'll also be sent a link to the recording of the session once it's available. Just quickly wrapping up with a few words about our partnership. This webinar was co-produced by MHPN and Emerging Minds for the Emerging Minds National Workforce Centre for Child Mental Health project. The National Workforce Centre is funded by the Australian Government Department of Health under the National Support for Child and Youth Mental Health Program. MHPN supports the engagement and ongoing maintenance of practitioner networks where clinicians from different disciplines meet regularly with other mental health practitioners, share tips and resources, build local referral pathways, and engage in CPD activities. Due to the current environment, most MHPN networks have been postponed. However, some are organising Zoom meetings. So contact your local coordinator or get in touch with MHPN to learn more about joining your local practitioner network and special interest groups. Or you can go to the news section of the MHPN website. Or you can indicate your interest in the exit survey. If you would like to continue the child and family practice discussion with... That's what I just mentioned. Never mind. Sorry, everyone. Before I close, I'd like to acknowledge the consumers and carers who have lived with mental illness in the past and those who continue to live with mental illness in the present. Thank you to all of our panellists, to my colleague Amelia, who's been taking care of the chat room this evening, to Julie and the team at MHPN and Redback for facilitating tonight's webinar for us, and to everyone who joined us. I hope you have a great evening. See you next time.